The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Happy Easter, everyone, and welcome back to the live exchange. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted today to be able to speak to accomplished investor and expert stock picker John Heumann of Vox Markets. So welcome, John.
Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
Yeah, not so bad. Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to a nice break. But before we get there, we've still got plenty of stocks to run through and lots of sort of questions from the audience. So anybody wants to put some questions to John or myself, then just drop them into the chat box. But over the past 2 weeks, we've had quite a bit of key macro data. We've had the central banks making decisions softer than expected, sort of inflation. But before we sort of dig into the details, John, I don't suppose you could quickly remind people what type of investor you are and what stocks you quite like.
So, what type of investor am I? I mean, I sort of have a leaning towards value, I must admit, although I do have some growth companies that I've invested in, and they have, as it happens, been my best performers. The value side of things is not working out particularly brilliantly, nor has it for some time generally. I sort of favour, deep research. I mean, I've been an analyst in a past life, an equity analyst, and was editor of the Investors Chronicle. So the whole, for nearly a decade, so the whole approach is very much driven by, digging into companies, really looking in depth at kind of the markets they operate in, the numbers behind them, and really sort of, kicking the tires yourself if you can. I love a bit of scuttlebutt. I do like getting out there and sort of experiencing the companies that I might invest in. I think it gives you lots of clues as to how well or not companies are.
Yeah, good. And then what's your sort of like just long term? What's your sort of your returns been? I know you've probably had difficulty investing because if you've been an analyst, you've been barred.
Yeah, but I mean, to be honest, I left the Investors Chronicle a few years ago and I really started sort of taking control of some of my money then. And prior to that, it was all run through, company pensions. So looking at that, the returns have done very well because actually a lot of that, the weighting is towards sort of, global indices and global indices are very much dominated by big tech, and big tech has done very, very well. So actually the whole pension side of things, which I rarely look at, has done extremely well. Over the past couple of years, it's been a difficult couple of years for investing. I've sat largely on cash, throughout the worst of it. So that's protected me really from some of the sort of vagaries of the market. And aside from that, I'd say I'm fairly flattish over the last couple of years, which I'm not too unhappy with, I have to say.
No, that's sort of outperformed the market, particularly on the small cap sector. Everybody's been absolutely battered.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not entirely small cap, I must admit as well. So, I've got a mix of large, small, a few investment trusts in there as well. I'm fairly agnostic in terms of size and asset type.
Okay, well, we'll go through those in a bit more detail later on. But just in terms of, I understand you've got a new sort of service, stock picking service, coming out in the next couple of months. Can you just talk a bit through what that is, what's it called, how you're seeing it, where is it positioned in, what it's going to offer investors?
Yeah, so listeners might remember a publication called Growth Company Investor, which has been running for many, many years.
That was David Thornton, wasn't it, John?
It is, and David's, the plan is for David to come aboard and right, so we've taken that over, and we're going to be sort of putting out the kind of in-depth research that I've alluded to earlier through that service. It will be, it won't be sort of daily news type stuff. You can get that through the Vox website itself. It's going to be more focused on producing in-depth bits of research on companies that we feel that we have conviction in as good picks. It might be sort of two reports a month, and hopefully expand from there. But it will be focused on the kind of in-depth, very much fundamentals driven research that I favour as an investor. We'd like to offer that to the public at large, and it will initially be free.
Wow, great. Fabulous, brilliant. Well, when's the likely go live date? Because I'll definitely be a subscriber.
I think we'll be up and running by sort of early May. I think that's the plan anyway.
Okay,
we've got a few stocks in mind. Some of them we might talk about today.
Okay, good. Well, we've had a few questions from the audience overnight, in fact, and one was from a guy called I think I don't do this very, very, very well, or I can't remember what exactly.
Not good at this share stuff.
Yeah, that's it. Not, anyway, he was asking about perennial disappointer. Actually, I remember owning this, but it's BT Group. Mm. And I remember being one of the El Cid variety who actually came in on the privatisation back in 1984. And I bought at original value or price at £1.30. It was a roaring share at the time. Did really well for me. And now it's below there, I think, £1.30.
So, £1.10. Is it £1.10?
Yeah, can you take, yeah. So that's, it's sort of totally tripped over, what, sort of 40 years. Can you take us through what your latest view on the BT is?
It's a real, you know, dog. In my portfolio, it has to be said. And the only reason I'm hanging on to it is because, you know, can it get any worse? so
is that an investment thesis?
In the case of, in this case, you know, there was a thesis behind it that, you know, that it was a sort of deep recovery play, that there were activist investors coming on board, that, you know, Openreach is actually quite a good business, that it's laying, you know, it's really investing heavily in its fibre network, and there were lots of, you know, tailwinds to really support that rollout for high-speed broadband across the country. You know, there were some underperforming parts of the business that could be turned around, and generally speaking, you know, the idea was, how much worse can it get? This was a company in, you know, in desperate need of the other rationale was that it would sell BT Sport as a non-core asset. Now, it didn't sell BT Sport, which I thought was a poor decision. You know, put it into a JV instead. You know, it feels non-core and expensive business to operate in, you know, highly competitive content. And you know, I know that there was this, you know, back, you know, sort of a decade or so ago, that, you know, there's this big trend towards, you know, what they call triple play. So, you know, you had companies offering broadband, landline, and mobile, and then you went quad play, so adding the content layer on top as well. But, you know, you've got a lot of specialist content services out there, and, you know, it feels incongruous to BT, and I really, as I say, was surprised they JV'd it rather than sold it. I think it's a mistake. And what was the other thing? I mean, you know, the BT business side of things, really, you know, it's been struggling for many, many, many years. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, you know, you should experience companies that you potentially invest in. And, you know, as a customer, my experience of this company recently has been diabolical, diabolical. I won't go into the details, but suffice to say, they really are not a joined up organization. They really have some issues on the sort of customer facing, customer service side of things. And this is a highly competitive market. So, you know, we know their numbers are okay, but it's because they're pushing prices up. And, you know, as you push prices up, people can go elsewhere. You know, there are other options than BT these days. So, you know, the consumer marketing side of things is faces from very stiff headwinds, I'd say.
Why don't you sell the shares then, John?
Why? Because you know, I've lost a fair amount on them, and you know, it may be that the activists, you know, get a bit louder and something actually happens here, and something really does need to happen. There is a new chief executive on board. I would love to chat to her to ask what her plan is to turn this company around. You know, both as a customer or ex-customer now and shareholder, what's the plan? So, give new management a chance, hear them set out their stall, and hope the activists actually somebody really start to make some noises that points this company in the right direction. The thing that moved the shares most recently was the sale of the old post office tower, BT Tower. I mean, you know, when it's a property deal that moves the share price of a big telecoms company, you know something's not quite right. But, you know, in BT's defence, this is a sector-wide issue.
Yeah,
there isn't much to like about the telecom sector in the UK. You've got Vodafone, Virgin Media, both of them are horrendous performers as well.
Yeah, telcos worldwide seem to be in pretty much dire straits. They can't compete against the big sort of like, you know, media and internet guys, unfortunately.
But why bother with the media? You know, stick to the knitting. You know, become the very best at something. And that should be providing connectivity. We are a connected world. How on earth can the companies that provide that connectivity not be doing well? It's insanity. Poor management, poor regulation in the UK. You know, I mean, it's you know, anecdotally, I took the train to Paris recently, and, you know, you're sort of, your network's dropping out as you're going towards the tunnel. You get on the other side of the channel, and it's like, you know, it's like sort of the heavens open and the sun shines down and the mobile 5G signal picks up and you don't lose it for the next week. Mm. You know, we've got something wrong with telecoms in this country. Yeah. Bad.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what they could do. This would be my plan, is that they should sell their infrastructure to an infrastructure investor because they've got a lot of money for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a plan many years ago, and certainly there was a suggestion that Openreach would be spun out. And again, you know, this is where there was a huge regulatory failure because, you know, they essentially Chinese walled it within BT itself. And you know, that was a very bad decision on the regulator's part. It should be a separate company. Openreach should be a separate company. It's where the expertise lies. And you know, a marketing and telecoms organization, which is what the other side of BT is, you know, separately makes a lot of sense. I agree. Spin out the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that's another reason for hanging on to the shares. Something might actually happen that's sensible. Yeah.
Well, it gets a nice dividend as well. And I did see the consensus target price for BT is £1.86 compared to £1.10. So yeah, there's plenty of upside. Okay, let's move to the, sort of like the other end of the market cap spectrum. We've got Angling Direct, which I think is only a 27 million market cap rather than a 10 billion market cap. And it's a specialist in sort of like fishing tackle and offering anglers equipment and stuff like this. But what sort of surprised me is that it's got a really good name. It's got a really good brand, but its margins are really small. It's only like 2% EBIT margins.
Right, so it's a volume business, isn't it, really? But you know, it's just so cheap. You know, you talk about 27 million market cap, it's sitting on, you know, best part of 15 million of cash.
Yeah.
So you basically got, you know, the UK's leading supplier of angling equipment trading on an enterprise value of, you know, just over 10. This is deep value, and it's a very good company. You know, the numbers were out recently, they were very, very good. But, you know, I think there's some concerns about its European business. So, you know, it does compete in Europe online, whereas in the UK it's a mix of online and physical retail. But Europe is a very sort of price competitive market. So you know, there is a concern that is a drag on the business. It's opening a shop in the Netherlands very soon, in fact. But yeah, no, UK sales were decent, and this is, you know, this is a very, very popular sport, very, very popular sport. Not the one that I engage in, but you know, I understand, living out in the sticks as I do, you know, there's a lot of people that love their angling.
You haven't scuttlebutted this one at all.
I've got a lot of friends who are anglers, and this, you know, there's my scuttlebutt. My scuttlebutt. But it's, you know, a very decent company, and I say, you know, that cash pile, and you know, just really, really, you know, means the shares are outstandingly cheap.
Yeah. Can you see the shares there? Can you see the chart there, John?
Mm-mm,
okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what price would you say is fair value? I did actually look at the brokers. We've got 48p from Singers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I think there's just a structural growth story in here. I don't tend to look at target prices. I, you know, if I like the business, and you know, there's room for expansion, and you know, as I say, the European side of things could evolve quite nicely. Although it's the worry at the moment. Then you know, I just sort of hang on because I think there's upside. There's a big strategic investor came in, a company called Kelsa. You know, took quite a chunky stake. And you know, it's easy to see why, but yeah. So I don't look at target prices, but you know, there is definitely room for profit expansion here.
Yeah, that's Kelso's John. I can't remember what his name is. He's the CEO, isn't he? John, the guy from it was one of the brokers, wasn't he? I can't remember. Anyway, he specializes in retail. Okay, good. Well, let's move to another one. I mean, I'd love to highlight, I actually own Michelmersh Brick, which is a premium brick manufacturer, which again is super cheap. It does building products, obviously, and that sector has been absolutely battered of late. But it came out with surprisingly good results this week compared to the rest of the market. I mean, in big picture wise, we've seen brick volumes over 2023 reduced by over 30%, but actually their sort of like sales increased like for like 1 or 2%. So they held up, and you have to ask why they held up. And the main reason is is that around about a third of their business is in sort of architectural, sort of like bespoke buildings. So it goes into train stations, museums, schools, universities, which like their buildings to be aesthetically pleasing. Another 40% goes into repair and maintenance. So your old sort of like, you know, properties that like to need a new wall or need new chimneys and this sort of stuff. And it's all sort of like, you know, bespoke niche stuff. They only have about 6% of the market. So you're talking of sort of 75% of the business is outside of new build. It's the new build which has been the weaker area. But imports have also, which is where large competition have also decreased. And so actually, even though they nudged down their forecast for 2024, the actual shares went up. And let me just put the share price on. So they've done remarkably well. Their biggest competitors, and there's three major manufacturers in the UK. There's Ipstock, Fortera, and Wernerberger, and they own about sort of 80% of the market. But Michaelmas have ran about sort of, let me just put it up now. I've got it up. there we go. You can see that, yeah. John, you can see the chart.
Yeah.
And I mean, the shares, even though they've moved up, are still only trading at around about 10 times PE, and they've got £11 million of cash as well. And I just think this is a perfect one, just to lock in, hold. I own it. I think you own the Anglia Direct as well, and BT. And I'm just going to hold it, and I've held it for, you know, I've had it many a time in the past as well. And I just think, you know, at some point in time, you're probably going to see consolidation. But even if you don't, then there's plenty of upside, because this one should trade at roughly around about 8 times EBITDA. And I've got a price target. Well, I've got a fair value of about, I think it's 165, whereas I think Canaccord are about 180 or something like that. So I think there's plenty of upside. I don't know what you think of the building product sector, John.
I mean, I wouldn't have touched it for a while. Just as you say, that, you know, the housing, the house building sector has been, you know, horrendous. And we've seen some horrible numbers coming from some of the larger house builders, you know, over the past year or so. You know, you've seen a significant reduction in house building output.
Yeah.
As you say, you know, you don't want to be, you know, focused on, you don't want to be invested in anything that's going to see their own volumes fall as a result of that. You know, the Mitchell Merge case does make sense. You know, you look around here in Suffolk, where we have lots of sort of, you know, historic buildings, there is a lot of work going on. And you know, these buildings have to be restored sympathetically, as you've alluded to. There's a lot of sort of infrastructure projects that are happening, you know, in a sort of wider area. So it makes sense. But, you know, I think it's very, it's cyclical. And, you know, we've been through a down cycle. What we might see, you know, we've got an election coming up. There's going to be some significant commitments to housing output. You know, we're nowhere near our housing targets. You know, I think we need 300,000 homes a year.
Mm.
So you can see there being some real sort of political impetus behind that sector, and that will in turn flow through to the building product sector. What I like in housing construction is the partnership model. So Vistry was the first company to go down this route. And it's really working in conjunction with sort of local authorities to build much needed social accommodation. I think this is something we'll see a lot more of, and that I think will really, really drive the sector. And as in turn, the building materials sector will follow. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know which comes first, the house builders or the building materials. One or the other is going to move first. I don't know which one it is.
Well, it's interesting. The share price the house builders already have, and Vistry has but the building products haven't yet. And I think it's going to come.
There you go. So it will come. It will follow.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one question that we've come in is just in terms of sort of like, you know, that the logic, etc., of moving. Normally, stock markets move ahead of the economy, but in the small cap sector, and we've seen that in the large cap, but in the small cap, it actually hasn't moved at all. How do you sort of square that? Because it's really weird, isn't it? Because the point is well made in terms of, you normally expect the stock market to lead the economy by 6 months, but in the small cap, it's still dire.
Yeah, I mean, I think the UK market has been a bit of an outlier, and, you know, in terms of sort of stock market theory. You know, it's a pariah market for various reasons. you know, we've seen massive outflows massive outflows. You know, there's been, you know, significant risk off, and obviously that's going to hurt smaller companies more than larger ones. But the UK generally has not been an attractive investment destination for some time. You know, and that's felt more keenly at the bottom end of the market. It's been, you know, I did an interview with a guy called Neil Wilson, who works at a company called Finalto. There's podcast up on our site, but over leverage, and we talk about what's wrong with the UK market. You know, and there's sort of lots of efforts afoot to try and, you know, create some stimulus that will attract investment to the UK, including, you know, talking about British ISA, for example. So yeah, I mean, it's pure outflows. It's just people don't want to put their money in the market at the moment.
I think that's be temporary, though, shouldn't it? But at some point, that's going to change.
We would hope so. You would think so. You know, there is sort of mean reversion as a powerful force in stock markets. But what will change it? And, you know, what's really been problematic for the UK is that, you know, there is one big trade that the rest, and it's not just the UK that suffers, but the UK has felt it, you know, worse than others, is that the big trade that nobody's wanted to miss out on is the Magnificent Seven. So much money has been sucked out of everything to go into those stocks, which have performed magnificently. That's where the trade is. That's been the trade. And if you're, you know, if you're invested in the Magnificent Seven, you obviously don't have capital to allocate elsewhere. So it's been problematic.
As passives being a part of that as well, because
it would be, yeah, because it's the same principle. You know, if you're in a FTSE All World Index, that's money essentially flowing into big tech, which is, you know, makes up such a huge proportion of global markets. So yeah, I would say passives have been part of that, and I say that FOMO trade on big tech.
Well, that must be very good for your new growth company investor service for next month, isn't it? Because if all the money's been running to one direction, yeah, indiscriminately, it's been running away from small caps. And I mean, there must be lots and lots of good value. Something to look forward to. Anyway.
I do think there is a hell of a lot of value out there. It's just, you know, it's just one of those things. It's been a long time coming that value. We thought we saw a glimpse of it, yeah, not that long ago, that value had started to perform again. Really, that was sort of during the beginnings of the inflationary crisis and the conflict in Ukraine, where you know the big deep value stocks in the UK, and you know you're talking about your Shells and the banks, and you know started to perform. So it seemed for a bit like value was the place to be.
Yeah,
and obviously, you know, as inflation rose and interest rates rose, the small cap world was not the place to be. You know, the ones with the sort of, you know, the kind of the longer discounted cash flow problem. But you know, there's deep value in small caps now. But as I say, it's just one of those, it's an elusive performance from value as a strategy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing what you're going to be picking anyway, because as I say, lots of one stock that I know you own is 10. Lifestyle has actually had a bit of sort of like capital sucked out of it by that exact trend. Let me put the chart up. Can you give us your latest view on this one? Because it effectively does sort of concierge services for well-heeled people in the banks and their customers and stuff like that. And just talk through its USP, what it does.
It's a nice company. So, you know, it basically works with wealth managers, high-end banks, to provide, as you say, lifestyle services, concierge services, you know, travel, event tickets, that kind of stuff, experience, food experiences, holidays, you know, to their customers. So it's sort of like, you know, it's like a, you know, when you get a NatWest premium account, you might get some things like phone insurance chucked in, but it's like kind of that on a sort of different level.
On steroids.
Absolutely, yeah. So you know, and it's basically a business that, you know, it's all about having the right contacts in the industry to be able to offer, to get these things so that, you know, these kind of hard to get things. I think like Glastonbury tickets, you know, impossible to get if you don't, you know, jump on the queue at the beginning. But Ten has put a network in place, so it has access to these kind of tickets and event tickets. Yeah, Wimbledon centre court tickets, you know, imagine how hard they are to get. And it's a, you know, banks sign up because this is a great attraction for potential clients of theirs, yeah, potential customers, who then, you know, say access these services through their accounts. So I just recently signed a deal with big Saudi Arabian bank. You know, this is the kind of level we're talking about, the kind of wealth we're talking about. It's just a really nice little company. It's hit that critical mass, that point of critical mass. And I think we can expect, you know, profits to start really growing from here. The groundwork has been laid over many years, and you know, it's got a very decent customer base, very strong network of partners who you know, whose products it provides through these banking arrangements, and the growth will come from here.
Where's the growth? Is the growth coming from essentially a new market? You're effectively on selling. You've got some high profile clients, banks, etc., and then it's convincing other effectively big corporates that this service is useful for them, and therefore that. So it's basically a TAM which is increasing in size because more people see the benefits of using these services.
Yeah, you basically, you know, it's new arrangements with you know, high level arrangements with banking partners, customers, and also then you know, encouraging those banking customers to use the service to become Sunlight calls active members. So if you actually look at the active member numbers, they're up 13% over the year, so 356,000. So you know, it's a combination of two things,
right? Okay, good. Well, let's move to the other end of the spectrum. Is that with H&T, which I think is the UK's biggest pawnbroker, which it is. You own. So you've got a sort of like you've got a pro cyclical play in Ted Lifestyle, and you've got a counter cyclical in H&T.
I don't think Ted Lifestyle is cyclical. I don't think that's a cyclical business. I think the wealthy are wealthy. They spend, you know, through the ups and downs of economic cycles.
Burberry Diageo have definitely had issues.
Yeah, no, but you will. But you've actually seen a lot of, you know, shift. The reason you're seeing a lot of the issues in sort of the luxury goods space is actually a shift from spending on stuff. So, you know, spending on that Burberry handbag, or, you know, spending on a high end bottle of spirits, or spending on a Rolex into experiences. So the money is shifting around the economy. So they're still spending. They're just spending somewhere else. Right. So, you know, and this is sort of pent up demand from obviously, you know, a few years of very disrupted travel plans.
Right. H&T is a counter cyclical play. Its pledge book has gone really well, hasn't it?
The pledge book is growing. You know, really growing very, very, very strongly. Yeah, net asset value in the business is growing very strongly. I mean, it did sort of warn earlier in the year, and it's basically the result of some weakness in the retail business. So obviously, you know, when someone brings in a watch to pledge and doesn't come back, they sell it. But the retail business has been weak. You know, we've seen this across the sector. Watches of Switzerland have obviously performed very badly. But in their case, it's as much a result of, you know, problems with supply, as it is demand. It's been tough. But in terms of, you know, what H&T is, which is a means for people to, you know, obtain small loans, and you know, this is, you know, in an economy like ours, this is, you know, important. There are very few sources of credit available for, you know, large swathes of society, especially now your sort of payday lenders have largely disappeared. So H&T is in a very good position to really, you know, meet that need. It's also I bought a company recently, you know, a pledge book, pawn book of a company called Maxcroft Securities, which is in Ilford, Gants Hill, a place I know well. You grew up there.
Are you a customer of H&T?
No, I'm not. But Maxcroft takes, it's more SME lending, so larger scale loans. Again, you know, financing small businesses is very neat, very important. There have been very, very, you know, serious difficulties for small businesses to raise finance. There is a company that, you know, I should mention in that regard, which is Time Finance, which has done, you know, a cracking job of tapping into that market. One I brought up on a stock screen ages ago and didn't buy.
There's lots of FOMO around nowadays.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, easy come, easy
go.
I would
totally agree with you on that. I think H&T, I mean, it's still it trades at less than 7x PE. Mm. And, you know, I mean, it's got a decent balance. It's got a good balance sheet. And it's sort of, as you say, it should be able to give you a bit of hedging in your portfolio if the economy does turn south badly. It's doing well anyway at the moment, but even if it did turn south, then it would give you that extra hedge, I guess.
Yeah, it's just a nice little business, really. Nice little business, nice big business now. Yeah. And I think, again, there's room for expansion. There's room for consolidation as well. You know, you do have other pawnbroker play. Ramsden's is another one that springs to mind. Yeah. Also, you know, similar but smaller and similarly cheap. And the other thing they do is, you know, foreign exchange. So, you know, again, they're sort of, they are a beneficiary indirectly of that shift in spending towards travel and experiences.
Yeah. Got a quick comment from Fredo300 says, cracking job there, John. So he likes your comments and your shirt, I think, as well. But in terms of portfolio construction, how do you sort of like manage that with the risk and stuff, big caps, small caps, and also sort of, you know, your dividend income, just quickly, broadly?
To be honest, I just buy companies that I like at the moment. It's not.
that is a straight and as honest an answer I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I buy things that I think, you know, off represent good value, and you know, it's not to say they always do, because we'll come onto one that has performed badly. But I like the company. There are aspects of a company that I like. I like, you know, generally speaking, when a company is doing something that I think is good. But you know, it says, yeah, construction. I don't pay a huge amount of thought. I mean, it's not a big enough portfolio to worry substantially about asset allocation. And as I say, I do get that through other investments that I hold. This is more a sort of thing. This is a portfolio I run for the fun of investing. And you know, there's other things I keep my own. But yeah, there's no need to really worry about asset allocation, risk management, and this thing. I have sold stuff in the past. You know, I've only ever sold one stock, actually.
Have you? Not BT.
No, I sold Sumero at a very large loss, concrete leveling, mainly because I really couldn't see the way back for that, and it's been proven correct that those shares have been languishing for some time.
Yeah,
might dip back in at some point.
Yeah. Well sold. It's an important highlight to investors. An important attribute to be a good stock picker and to be a long term is, as you plan to take, you know, it's got to be fun, i.e. you enjoy it. And that means you put your, it's important to have skin in the game, but there's another saying, it's important to have soul in the game. And I think, you know, I say highlight, if you've got somebody like John who puts all his efforts and he does it because he enjoys it, then, you know, you hopefully get better outcomes and lasting. But anyway, we'll move on.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another stock that I'd like to highlight to investors. Is Speedy Hire in the sort of like, it basically does plant hire for construction firms, house building and infrastructure, and the shares in the whole sector have done absolutely terrible. It came out with a profit warning just before Christmas. It actually been hit by some warmer weather because it usually hires out quite a lot of heating equipment to builders and to constructors, and because it was so warm they didn't need it. So the utilization rates on that part of the business didn't do so well. And also, you know, some of the wetter weather also didn't help in terms of construction side. But what I like about it, I mean, it's just frankly too cheap. It's as good to me. It's a good solid recovery play. It's got a decent balance sheet. It's got, you know, it's sort of like just over 1x net debt to EBITDA is just over 1x. It trades at about 5.5x PE. It trades at sort of less than 3x EBITDA. And I mean, basically, if you just look at it on a net tangible assets, you strip out its intangibles. It's got a, you know, net tangible assets is about 34p. Shares today are trading at 25. And I mean, just frankly, it's too low. If you used it as a modest 4x EBITDA multiple, you get to, you know, 60p. And if you use a traditional, you know, industry standard of 6x EBITDA, you get to a pound. And Liberum have got sort of 54p as a target price. Yes, obviously house building is weak at the moment, but frankly, that will turn and people will do more DIY. And I just think this has just been left dead and buried. And I, for somebody who wants a solid share, in my view, because there aren't that many, there's Speedy Hire, there's HSS, and there's VP, and Ashtead have also got their Sunbelt division in the UK as well. So there aren't that many big players of scale. and they're doing some quite interesting things, Speedy Hire. They've got an agreement with B&Q to help their distribution, and they've also got one into new sort of like electrification products or hydrogen products with AFC. So they're doing some quite interesting things, and they're certainly helping the planet in terms of moving their equipment to more electric based rather than sort of, you know, sort of diesel based or petrol based. I don't know if you've ever had a look at this one, John. It just seems mispriced to me.
Yeah, I haven't. It's probably sort of in the same sort of vein as the building materials.
Yes, sector. It is.
You know, you will see a recovery. It's very, very cyclical. That recovery will come at some point. And you know, as long as it can manage the down periods, the quiet periods, then you know, it should be in a decent position to benefit when the upswing comes, when the upcycle comes. Just looking at it now, big fat dividend. This one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even if they have to halve it, it's still not a massive problem.
So, you know, again, it's a tough year, but that's where you'll find value in tough times. But you know, it's sort of, and Ashton is the same. It's been a great company over the long term, but you know, you look at the last couple of years, it's been horrendous. We had a big sell off in 2021, it's bounced back, and the same will happen here. You know, people don't stop building things.
No, and I think that if you look sort of like over the secular growth, I mean, you just look at sort of the infrastructure projects, which is probably at least a third, if not 40% of the business. You've got still HS2. Obviously, they've cancelled the northern side, but they've still got the south side. It's got years of stuff.
Oh, it's a hell of a project. I drove past, saw it for the first time when we were on our way to Marlow.
Well, my neck of the woods in Burnley.
Yeah, it's quite an extraordinary thing. You know, some of the viaducts they've had to build, some of the tunnels that they've had to dig. I mean, it's an engineering product to behold. Project to behold. But yeah, there's a lot of infrastructure required in this country.
You've got Sizewell C.
Yep, around the corner to me.
You've got the new nuclear, which is the small form. You've got energy transition to to hydrogen, and then you've got all the offshore wind. So when you look at it through that lens of sort of like big infrastructure, I mean, these are just like mega decades, multi tens of billions. Then these are one of the guys who are going to do it.
And where do you stop? You know, we've got a load of schools that need rebuilding. We've got hospitals that need the significant physical infrastructure investment in them. So I think infrastructure is a good play, and you know, there's lots of companies that benefit from that. But you know, indirectly, Speedy Hire should be a beneficiary of what I suspect will be the sort of upswing in the infrastructure cycle. And again, it's sort of that correlates with the political cycle, and we have a general election some point this year.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move to another stock. Well, it's a stock that we both like, but you own, I don't, and has done rippingly well for you, is HVivo, which is a sort of like, I think it's a bit of a picks and shovels play on sort of like doing challenge trials for new vaccines and infectious sort of like, you know, biopharma. Could you take us through this one? Because it really has performed tremendously over the last two or three years.
Yeah, it's a fabulous business. And you know, I was lucky enough to speak to Mo Khan, the chief exec, a few times. And you know, the more I spoke to him, the more I thought, you know, this is a serious business.
Yeah.
You know, again, it was sort of on the cusp of profitability, but it's hit that. It's past that point, and now it's just, you know, from here it's the only way is up. As you say, you know, it manages these sort of human, it produces these human challenge models, which basically help companies understand the efficacy of the drugs that they're trying to produce, and you know, sort of predictiveness in that. So it really helps companies, biotechs and biopharmas get drugs to market, you know, more effectively. And that's, you know, improves the cost, and it improves the kind of potential the outcomes of clinical trials, which you know, in the past have been prone to failure. You know, very difficult.
Does anybody else do this, John? Or is it just unique?
I don't know. I mean, they do. They have another division which does sort of, laboratory services, which does have competitors. But the human challenge trial thing, I think, is fairly unique. They're expanding the portfolio of diseases that they look at. You know, sort of largely respiratory diseases. And the range of customers they're working with. So you know, they picked up business in Asia Pacific. You know, they get a lot of repeat business from large pharma groups that they're working with. You know, the order book is, oh, we've got 90% of 2024's revenue in the bag already.
I understand Pfizer's a big customer of it.
Yeah, they don't. They never really talk specifically about their customers, but you would imagine, you know, there are very few large names that won't be working with HBO somewhere along the line. And but there is more to go. You know, there are seriously, you know, unmet needs in respiratory disease, RSV being one of them. So you know, you've got this company which, as you rightly point out, it's picks and shovels. It's there. You know, without the risk of drug development, it comes with drug development risk, huge rewards, but you know, risky as well when drugs don't make it through. HBO sort of, you know, benefits either way. But as it happens, it's helping companies, you know, as I say, improve the outcome, improve the likelihood that the drugs they're developing will make it through clinical trials. It's fantastic business. They're expanding their capacity, so they've taken some space down in Canary Wharf, which they're turning into what they call flu camp, which is where volunteers can go along and be infected so that they can be analysed. That, you know, they say this drug can be analysed. And they'll basically have, it will be a one-stop shop in there. It will be sort of a lab capacity in there as well. Funny enough, in the budget, this might have gone unnoticed, but there was a mention that the government is very keen to turn Canary Wharf into a life sciences hub. Because actually, yes, as we know, some banks are moving out of Canary Wharf now. So Canary Wharf is undergoing a bit of a transition. And the transition is towards life sciences, and HVO is kind of leading the pack there.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I guess given the shares have tripled over the past sort of like, year or so, would there be ever point your top slice? Or this is really a case of running winners because the market's massive?
Keep adding.
Yeah.
And I've added to this a couple of times. You know, I don't want to get too far ahead. I don't want to go too bonkers, you know, but I'm in no hurry to sell any of this at the moment. And as I say, I would add rather than sell. You know, when we look at forecast P of 20, which for a growth company like this is just, that seems very, very, very cheap. It's paying a dividend. You know, it's a growth company paying a dividend, 55% earnings growth for next year. All its revenues are in the bag, pretty much for 2024. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's and I really, as I really rate Mo, the chief exec.
He's a force of nature, is he?
He's incredibly, incredibly good, incredibly switched on.
Yeah, good. No, I would agree. I don't think there's any reason to push the shell button on that one. I think it's just got rocket boosters, and it seems to have the market itself. So. It's sold out. You're crazy to take, unless you've got an unbelievable opportunity elsewhere. But that seems to be plenty to go. Okay.
This is by far and away the best stock in my portfolio, performance wise.
Well, hey, I wish I'd three bagged in 18 months. So well done.
I didn't quite do that well.
I know. Another one in the healthcare sector I'd just like to highlight to investors, I don't own it, is Advanced Medical Solutions. So let me just get the price up, the share price. And the reason why I like it, it's got really a lot of unique technology in wound care. So it basically does things like, you know, adhesives and glues, and it does stitches and ways of when people are into like in hospital and stuff, it helps accelerate that whole healing process, etc., and coagulants and this sort of stuff on deep wounds. It stumbled just recently over the last 18 months. It had a distribution issue out in the States that reduced some of its sales volumes last year. But what's really sort of caught my eye is that the prices, you know, the shares have come down into reasonable sort of value territory. And it's just bought originally a transformational acquisition of Peter's Surgical about 2 weeks ago. And it's an absolute, you know, sort of like great fit for the business in terms of product distribution, geographical spread, et cetera. And I don't think the market's really seen what this means. And I think it could really accelerate the EPS growth, not only through top line and getting back to sort of like high single digits, maybe even low digits or get organic growth, you know, volume and pricing on the top line, but also improve the profit margins. And the profit margins are still good. They're about 17% forecast for this year for EBIT. But I think you'll get well above 20% once you've integrated these two businesses together. And just running the numbers, I mean, I know that the shares have sort of like, you know, just flat lined since it, et cetera. But I mean, you've got Numis at a target price of 250. But if you just, even if you put a sort of like just you don't put any growth into it and just put a normal sort of 20-21% EBIT margins on it, then you get to sort of like 45 million of EBIT for, you know, sort of like in a year's time. You put a 15 times EBIT multiple on that, you get £2.80. And so I would say for a really rock solid, high IPR rich healthcare stock that's got great distribution across the Western world, particularly in Europe and the States and stuff, I don't think you can go too far wrong with this one. And to be honest, I'll be not surprised if Smith and Nephew bought these, because they want to boost up their wound healing business. And this is going to have joint revenue of over £220 million. So looks a high quality stock trading and not really seen really that much, you know, not really sort of, you know, picked up by investors yet. What's your view?
Looks nice. I'm just looking at the numbers now. I presume it spent a large chunk of, I mean, it's had a lot of cash. I presume a lot of that is going to go into this acquisition.
Yeah, the sort of pro forma EBIT net debt to EBITDA after the acquisition is about 1.5, which is absolutely fine, because this is recurring revenue streams and it will come down rapidly because it's a massive cash generator.
Yeah, it looks hugely cash generative. Looking at these forecasts that I'm looking at, the net borrowing was forecast to, or net cash rather, was, you know, by around $20 million a year. So, yeah, you know, big chunks of cash coming into the business.
Yeah.
Lots of green on the SharePad summary page.
Oh, is there? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Is that a good sign or a bad sign, green?
It's a good sign. Green is good. Red is bad.
Oh, okay.
Really decent earnings growth, decent dividend. No, not huge, but, you know, we like dividend growers as much as, you know, the ones that pay a large chunky dividend.
Yeah.
Decent returns on capital, decent margins.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you might be right. Smith and Nephew needs to do something. That's been a serial disappointer.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's another one I quite like, actually, as a lead version play. But let's not discuss that one. Let's go to a smaller one, actually, that you own is Paul Begg Pharma, which I think was a spin out from Open Orphan. In fact,
it was
another one, which came out,
basically Open Orphan, which was HVO as was. And Paul Begg was spun out of that. Paul Begg is the drug discovery side of things.
Yeah.
I've never really, it's a sector that I've always been wary of because of the high risk of failure attached to, drug development. But I feel that Paul Begg is doing something slightly different. Again, I spoke to the chief exec, Jeremy Skillingson, quite a few times, impressive guy. They're using HVO's models, you know, human challenge models to expedite their drug discovery process. They're using AI. Which is a big trend in healthcare. You know, this is analyzing data in ways that could just simply not be done in the past. And, you know, that really does, you know, reduce the risk of failure, of a clinical trial failure significantly. Again, meeting unmet needs. Respiratory illnesses. They're working with one of the applications they found for their lead drugs, POLB001, is in cancer care. So you're getting sort of a lot of modern, and I know this is an area that you look at, Paul, through some other companies, but that you're getting a lot of sort of modern cancer treatments, CAR T therapies, immunotherapies. Great, you know, these are hugely effective at treating cancer, but they come with quite a significant side effect. It's called a cytokine release storm.
Yes.
And what Paul Begg has realized is that actually its drug can really, you know, basically it's preventative for the cytokine release storm potentially. And this is huge because, you know, CAR T therapies, immunotherapies is the growth area of cancer. And Paul Begg is in the right place with a potential companion therapy for that, which actually makes the whole market work. The whole CAR, you know, at the moment it's very hard to administer. You've got to be in hospital or a very specialist cancer center to have these immunotherapies in case you suffer, you know, a serious life-threatening cytokine release storm. Paul Begg's potentially broadens the market, means that this you know, cutting edge cancer care therapy can be delivered elsewhere. And there are many other things that it's doing as well. Fascinating company.
When you were just talking about it, I was just thinking that scenario, it's going to come, isn't it, at some point? We're going to get another variety of COVID or airborne sort of bacteria. That we're not going to have a vaccine immediately. We'll be able to sort it later on. But in that interim period, rather than actually locking everybody down, if Paul Begg actually have a drug out there that helps people get through, you know, if you turn the clock back 4 years ago, the biggest killer of you know, from COVID was actually psychostorm, wasn't it?
Yeah,
basically that immunoreaction. And if you have a drug that actually can help people get through the hospital, then these guys that would be in a perfect position. And it's a matter of when, not if, we get something like that again. And unfortunately, that's the reality of the situation.
Does feel that way, and this is today's modern world. But so I think, you know, again, Paul Begg's in the right place. He's moving into the rare disease space as well, which is, you know, very, very, very lucrative. It's brought team on board from a company. Oh God.
Oh, Amrit Pharma.
Amrit. Thank you, Paul. Amrit was, again, there is a guy who sits behind us, Cahill Friel, who's brought many companies to market and was very successful with Amrit, and he's brought that team across into Paul Begg. So, you know, it's a sector which I think is one that investors need to navigate cautiously, but I feel this is a company that has all the right ingredients to be extremely successful.
Mm. Well, I'll give you a bit of good news on Amrit Pharma. The guys are first class. They did a brilliant job. And what I would say, expect Paul Begg to be buying stuff, you know, other businesses, other target candidates, or even probably stuff that's actually in the outside the clinic, actually in commercial development as well, or very close to it, because they really did a brilliant job, and they know how to work those businesses. So I think my instinct would be there's going to be lots of really good news flow. You wouldn't get a team that capable going into a smaller business like Paul Begg unless they saw huge opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Okay, good. We've had another question for you here. It's from Fredo again. He's asking about Norbin Broadbent, the recruiter. I don't know if you know about it. I think he does mainly... my member rightly, it does mainly sort of executive search.
Yeah.
So it's your neck of the woods there, John. Not your blue collar, and this is your big hitters like you.
Yes, thanks, Paul. Recruitment is, I haven't looked at this company very much. I've tended to avoid. I've never really liked recruitment as a sector. Again, you know, it seems very cyclical. The specialists tend to do better. So, you know, where you've got companies that have had a specialism in something like STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, medicine, they've tended to be a bit more resilient than sort of more general recruitment, like, you know, Hayes, for example. Norbin Broadbent executive search, I mean, I haven't looked at the numbers. They had some news out this week, didn't they?
Yeah, I think the shares went up. I mean, my take on Norbin Broadbent, I mean, basically, is it's basically got a decent brand and it'll be bought out by somebody. It's run by a pretty good exec chairman, I think. I know Judith McKenzie owns some shares in it and she's not stupid. And although it's quite a small business, I'm not sure what the market cap is. But
it's very small, 6 million.
Yeah. My instinct is that once the sort of the dial changes in terms of, here was the there's the sales, okay. Well, yeah, it's basically trade. Well, that's the historical sales. Only goes to 2022, but this will have a lot of operating leverage. And if the market turns, it's going to be tough. It's just got to get through. I don't know how much debt it is. It's just got to get through the next 12 months, which will be tough for recruitment.
Yeah, but I mean, you can see it in those numbers there, though. It's sort of net sales. You know, they've dipped.
Yeah.
Or rising again, you know, so you see the cyclicality inherent in this kind of company, which is why it's a sector I've never really liked. But who's to say that, you know, that this, you know, isn't a company that has a, you know, some significant recovery prospects ahead of it. I mean, look at the revenue growth.
Yeah.
Net free income up 44% in its final results last year. And that's a pretty impressive performance, albeit from a weak year.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's move to a slightly, again, a bigger firm you've probably held for some time, Unilever. Now, this is the company I know quite well, because that was my first job after graduation, Unilever. So all things brand, basically Persil and personal products. And it's just announced, it's had a new CEO who came in. And he's been under a lot of pressure, basically, to rationalize its SKUs, its product lineup, improve the top line growth, improve the margins, and really get this business growing a bit like P&G and other big consumer good companies. One of his ideas is to chop a lot of people out of the business, take out middle management, and also to demerge or spin out its ice cream business. So what's your views latest on this one?
It's been a good performer for me, actually, strangely. Yeah, but you know, I think you kind of alluded when we were speaking before, it's a sort of recovery plan. And it kind of is. I mean, they almost got bought a few years ago, if you remember.
Yes, they did. Right. Good point. Good spot.
And then they had to you know, mount quite a robust defence. And that defence is basically, we will turn this business around. So, and it wasn't not a turnaround from, you know, a disaster, but really sort of just really lackluster growth. Mm. This whole industry is a funny industry. I mean, it's always, everyone's always selling something to someone else. It's always moving around, you know.
Brands
moving around. So you know, it makes sense to spin out the ice cream business, which had been, you know, a good performer, probably then not such a good performer. But yeah, why not? This is, you know, GSK has done it with its, you know, its personal care division.
Haleon.
You know, so this is the way. The mergers create value. So good. Mm. Excellent. The shares about 5% on this news, which was great. But I like, you know, it pays a nice dividend. I've you know, got no problems hanging on to this one. The thing that attracted me to this, it was going back some time now. I was chatting to a guy who you may know called Nick Train.
Yes.
Who runs one of the
best
known investment trusts, the Finsbury Growth and Income Investment Trust. And I was sort of probing him about, you know, why do you hold Unilever? This is not really a growth company, you know. Where does it? And he likes baggers. He likes companies. He calls them baggers, you know, that can double and double again and double again. He's like, how can Unilever double from here? It's absolutely gigantic.
Well, that's just 30 years.
Yeah.
So you can see how it does actually.
Yeah, precisely. So you know, it's sort of like, okay, well, I take the point. But now, if you've got two slightly smaller companies. You know, law of large numbers suggests that they could, you know, more easily double than the sort of larger combined group, and that focus does tend to help companies. Mm. But the thing that Nick Train pointed out to me that I thought was most interesting is that Unilever actually holds a stake in Hindustan Lever.
Yeah, majority stake.
Majority stake.
But it's only 51%.
51%, something like that. Or maybe it's a bit more. I can't remember off the top.
Yeah,
of my
it could
head.
Be a bit more.
But you know, this is a very large personal care or, you know, consumer goods company in one of the fastest growing markets in the world. You know, India is red hot at the moment as an investment destination. You know, really performing strongly, really business friendly environment there, growing middle class, growing wealth from quite a low base. So you know, Nick Train's view is, well, you know, if they've got Hindustan Lever, you know, the profits accruing to Unilever from Hindustan Lever are going to become quite substantial as India's economy performs. So and he said, there is your opportunity for the next doubling and doubling and doubling.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, okay, makes sense.
Yeah, I wouldn't, I personally wouldn't bet against Unilever. I remember participating in the employee shares scheme when I first joined. It was at £4. So after 5 years, I checked out. I think I bought the shares at four and I sold at about, I don't know, 10 or 12 or 14 or something like that, because I wanted to buy a house and I made a nice profit. But the shares have carried on. They're 40 quid. And I'm with you. It's a top quality business that's been around for over a century. It's got enduring and very, you know, lovely brands. People are going to carry on using it. It'll go through. It survived wars. It survives pandemics. It ain't gonna have any problem with a recession because it's been through many of them.
Yeah, I mean, it can move the lever on price. You know, you do hear a lot of talk around, you know, the sort of rise of the own label. You know, the fact that people will trade down to own label products, the Aldi and Lidl, the versions of things. You know, will eat into Unilever's. You know, sales growth, volume growth. It has been hit, you know, in volume terms as the cost of living crisis has hit, but it is able to move the dial on pricing and you know, cost management as well. Mm. Yeah, as you say, it's a very, very high quality company, which I, as an ex-employee, you would know better than anyone else.
Yeah, well, I've heard that story, that old yarn, the death of the brands, for years. It ebbs and flows. It ebbs and flows.
Yeah, I mean, people like brands. I mean, it's just the way we're wired.
I used to tuck into their staff shops. It was brilliant. We used to also do a swap with Cadbury's, so we used to have their brands in there as well. Wow, I was a lot heavier back then.
Sounds all right.
Anyway, right, okay, well, I'll move to an edgy one here, and this is sort of like in the essence of, I don't own it, but I'm very I'm interested in this whole sector. In fact, I'm heavily weighted into international payments. Just to let people know, I own Equals, Argentex, and PayPal. And these would always do, these do digital payments cross border, but also within companies, etc. Anyway, this is a similar company, but a different business. It's Cab Payments. Now, this has been as hated a business on the stock market as you can possibly imagine. It was one of the few which IPO'd last year at £3.35. I think it raised about £290 million. Pounds, usually from largely selling shareholders. It's actually based a place I used to live where I bought my first house, Sutton, Surrey. So it's just around the corner from where I was. And its USP is that it does digital payments for hard to reach markets, principally places like Africa, South America, and the Middle East. And it has a big position in Africa. Now, people say, okay, what happened there? And the simple reason is that you had two things. You had a devaluation of the Naira, which is in Nigeria, and more importantly, you also had banking intervention on the I think it's the West African franc, which basically stopped all international digital payments. But a lot of them, made it really tough between Cameroon, Senegal, and I can't remember what the other one he uses it. Those three countries equate to at least 30% of their revenue. So it just basically dropped off a cliff. They had a profit warning. It's recovered a bit, came out with results this week. And actually, the balance sheet is pretty good. And the growth strategy is not too bad if you believe that emerging markets are eventually going to benefit from digital payments like the rest of the Western world. In fact, more likely to more rely on them even more. Their customers are not me and you, John. They're actually a lot of the banks, local banks, emerging market banks, international banks in the Western world wanting to make these, you know, sort of like payments abroad. And also they do a lot for charities in terms of, you know, disaster relief, moving money for them, etc. So they've got a very good client base. And they're just, to me, they're just frankly too cheap. I mean, they trade. I mean, I know you either say this is a value trap or a value play. I'm not sure, but it trades at sort of like less than 7x PE. It's got like 30 odd million of surplus capital, 4x EBITDA and 4.5x EBIT. And it's got, you know, so it's a sound balance sheet. The margins are still very good, still very profitable. I just think there'll be two things will happen. It's either, if I'm wrong, then there's a problem with their obviously balance sheet, and the auditors haven't picked it up, or there's a massive exposure somewhere, but I just don't believe it. Or alternatively, somebody are going to buy these. And I just think because everybody hates them, the fund managers and investors have just put it into the no touch bucket. I just think this looks like in a growth sector, in a growth market with good positions, good customers in emerging markets. So I think it just, to be absolutely clear, to be transparent, I'm not buying yet because I've got too much of my portfolio already in digital international payments. But if Equals is bought out and it releases some cash, this could well be somewhere I put some extra money, because I just think it's frankly too cheap. What's your view there, John?
I don't know. It's not one I've looked at. I must admit, I know that, you know, payments has been a very hot sector, but it's one that I've sort of kept to one side.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of years ago, I think there's a lot going on in payments, and too much for me to really start trying to get my head around it. You know, all the different flavors of payments. PayPal was the one that sort of really sort of struck me a couple of years ago. They had an absolute shocker. And you know, you're seeing, you know, other payment providers out there really sort of dominating this. I mean, this in terms of, you know, sort of shop payments. So Stripe has taken a lot of market share there. Obviously, these are sort of slightly different payments companies we're talking about, the more sort of, you know, the financial services.
These are B2B rather than consumer. Things.
And yeah, I just, as I say, it's just, I don't know enough about foreign exchange and digital payments in that B2B area to really feel comfortable investing in it. You know, I think you've got to do your research on stuff like this to, because they say they're all slightly different flavors, and I don't know the difference between one and the other. There you go. Well, I'm being honest. I don't understand sector.
Well, I'll be licking my lips in 2 months' time when we touch base again, John. Then you can tell me your view on international payments. Okay, we do have another question coming in from George Annan, and he asks about gaming realms, which I think basically is a mobile gaming or gambling company, and it does Slingo. I think it is Slingo Bingo. Basically, it's a mobile app that I think it doesn't sell itself. It sells the actual software to be like Playtech, but in a smaller sort of, like, you know, software niche. The shares look quite reasonable, actually. Yeah, I think they're reasonable. Have you ever had a look at this one at all?
I haven't. But it does look interesting. You know, this is, I mean, gaming is a big industry. It's a huge industry. You know, a lot of the UK gaming and listed gaming companies are really sort of focused on America. But there's a lot of innovation going on. A lot of innovation going on in this market. We do look at some companies in this, but I haven't looked at gaming realm specifically. It's certainly one I will have a look at because the numbers look very, very decent.
I think it trades at a pretty single digit PE, doesn't it?
I've got a forecast PE of 18 and a half on these, but that is way below the sort of forecast rate of earnings growth. Below it. So your peg, which is a ratio I do like to look at. Yeah. You know, the ratio of the PE to the rate of earnings growth is 0.4. So you know that valuation really said, I would say, doesn't fully reflect the pace at which this company is growing, looking at the summary figures here.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I've briefly looked at it before, and it's certainly something that I would consider buying, actually, because I think it's a high quality GARP company with a good brand, and it's the classic sort of, like, you know, brand name for you know, gaming, etc., that will go into a suite of products for the likes of MGM and you know, the big casinos who need a suite of casino products. So I can't see any reason why this won't continue doing well. What's the market cap on it there, John?
100.
Okay, well, I mean, there you go. These things, if they hit, it's like having a hit in gaming, isn't it? Or hitting, you know, at the meat of the box office. These things can absolutely do really well. And once you get that customer loyalty at the coalface, they like playing it, then, you know, you don't take it away. They just stays there forever.
Yeah. And it's really cash generative as well. You know, really lovely returns on capital, lovely margins. The cash is pouring in. So net borrowing forecast, or net cash forecast, is double basically this year to 15, and then hit 25 the year after that. So, I mean, you know, that obviously means that the shares will be even cheaper, essentially, on a sort of EV basis. No, it looks interesting.
Good. Well, let's switch sector to electrical audio equipment. We've got Focusrite, which was obviously a bit of a darling during lockdown because everybody was playing the banjo and trying to create a bit of music, but then unfortunately as people have already bought up new sort of, like, you know, audio equipment, etc., the shares have struggled a bit. Can you tell us what's your latest on this one, because it looks very high quality but going through a tough patch?
Yeah, it's gonna be, it's, I mean, I missed time my entry into this one. That's a very, you know,
you got it wrong.
Diplomat, got it badly wrong.
Join the club. I've got plenty like this.
But I like the company for various reasons. You know, I like its products. I use its products because I do. I wouldn't say play the banjo, but I do.
You make music there, John?
I do make a bit of music, yeah.
Dude, electronic what type?
Stuff. Electronic based music.
80s or more sort of, like, you got, is this the acid sort of variety?
Yeah, I call it acid house for the old folks.
Oh, wow, God. I didn't realize that. Fab. You'll have to give us a performance next time.
I think the jingle, I made the jingle for our new branding, our new video branding.
Oh, well done.
This week. So I like the company, I like the management, I like what it does. You know, it was a big downgrade, it's about 30%, but it's still making money. It has been acquiring, a sort of a studio equipment company, but really what it's acquired is a company called Martin Audio, which is a big sort of PA speaker kind of PA. So these are huge sound systems for, you know, very large concerts, you know, sort of Hyde Park festivals, that sort of thing. And these speakers are, you know, really, the technology in them is quite incredible. Because, you know, what you have at festivals is you need them to be loud enough for the crowd to hear, but not loud enough for the neighbours to hear. So basically, they sort of channel the sound the way that, you know, these are incredibly sonically efficient, these products. And, you know, again, the sort of festival market was, you know, whilst everyone was in the studio during lockdown, nobody was at the festivals or at concerts or whatever. So this is sort of giving it that balance. And I think we'll start to really see the Martin audio side of things, you know, really, really sort of drive the performance of this company whilst the studio market takes a bit of time to recover. I suspect, you know, that this, it is a fragmented market, you know, so there are lots of companies out there doing lots of similar things. You know, I use tools from all sorts of companies. There's a lot of German companies in this space. But it's not a market it has to itself, but it is an acquirer. So it's building up a nice suite of brands, as I say, some of which I have and use. So I like it. I like the company. I like the management. You know, it's very largely employee owned. So Phil Dudridge, who's a sound man for Led Zepp, who founded the company, basically gave a big chunk of it to the staff.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah, okay. And it just said, this isn't going to be AI, is it, the focus, right? Because essentially it's delivery of sound rather than production of, as in like, rather than creation of sound.
Well, it's both. So you've got the creativity side of the business, which is, you know, keyboards and software. And so there is AI potential in that. And then you've, as you say, the delivery that, you know, the speakers that you hear stuff through. There is the potential for AI to come into this to support the creative process. And it's a point I make about the integration of AI into many things, including, for example, journalism. It will be used within software products within this industry, but it will certainly not, you know, I don't think you're gonna get any robots making music that goes to number one. Well, you probably will.
You do already. I'm sorry. You do already.
Robot bands.
Yeah. Stock no. Aitken and Waterman was the back in our day.
Yeah, but there was a trick behind that. You can create manufactured music, and you know, you do have things
really?
Like auto tune. You know, that's a big thing in the industry. You don't have to be able to sing to be a pop star anymore. Yeah. Which, you know, is wizardry. It will get used, but, you know, as I say, you know, there is something lovely about the physical equipment that Focusrite makes, you know, the hardware. And actually, in a modern studio setting, it's a marriage of hardware and software that is sort of the holy grail. And you know, this is where the industry's going. Focusrite, being one of the players. Yeah it's been just a disastrous investment, but I still like it.
Yeah, just to digress, that AI implementation, are you putting any AI into your stock picking service at all?
No.
Would you ever consider it? Because I don't know if you've ever seen it. There's been a new service which is done called iFi AI, which is basically partnered with Watson X, that basically proclaims that actually it can help investors augment their talents in terms of predicting whether stocks are going to do good and bad using all this data and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, people have been trying to create models to predict the stock outcome of the stock market for centuries.
Yes. No, they have, yeah. Exactly.
There's a film about it. There's a film called Pi, and the man is trying to unlock the secrets to the stock market through maths. He drills a hole in his head to help him. Good for panning.
So sorry. You're saying it's a load of rubbish then?
Of course it is.
Okay, right, fine. Okay, we'll move on.
It's predicting the future. It's crystal ball stuff. Nonsense.
Okay, right. We've got Michael Mariner. He asks, any thoughts on water intelligence? I know a bit about this because I own it.
I'll leave that one to you then.
Yeah, let me just... where's that gone? Damn. Okay, I know where it is. Sorry, let me just get the chart up. There we go. That's it, yeah. I mean, basically, this one does, as people may or may not know, it does leak detection largely on a franchise basis model out in the States. And that's a really good, solid business. I mean, the key secular growth drivers are water efficiency, water cleanliness, and stopping sort of like, you know, the you know, sort of discharge of sewage and stuff like that in stormwater. Now, this is really quite interesting because its biggest business is in the States, but I don't know if anybody's had a look at the news recently, but apparently they've had a flood of solid waste into the Thames and liquid waste into the Thames, and they took on the BBC last night, they took a sample around Chiswick Bridge, I think, or Putney Bridge, where the Oxford boat race is going to be, and it came out yellow. It's the water. So it's an absolute disaster. And what the reason is because we've had so much rain across the UK that's caused storm sewage to come out of the drains and everywhere. And these guys actually do products in the UK that help the utilities solve that problem as well. So when it comes to sort of like, you know, water intelligence, I would say, you know, this is not going to shoot the lights out, but it's a real rock. It's a full position for me in my portfolio. These secular sort of like, you know, drivers of, you know, the whole, you know, climate change in terms of trying to stop the worst of droughts and water preservation, but also trying to stop the worst of the storm waters and you know, the extremes, etc. I just think this is in the right place at the right time. It's run by, you know, a management team that have done it for 20 years. It's come off a lot. It's cheap. And, I'm just going to hold it myself. But I don't know if you've ever had a look at this. I class this as a sleep at night safely stock.
Yeah, I've had a quick look at this. thematically, I like this sort of subset. So you've got another couple of companies that are involved in it in some way. I've lost you.
Have you lost me?
Oh, I don't know. It's all right. Well, there you are.
You got me. I've got you, so you're all right.
So you've got Ondo InsurTech in the UK, basically leak detection.
Yes.
Water intelligence is much more established. It's basically a franchise, if I understand it. It's buying
it is, yeah, in the States.
It's a sector that I was intrigued by. Water intelligence, I don't know why the share price has been going down. What's happened there?
Largely because of the new build and housing out in the States, because it's been soft. Because there just hasn't been, you know, that much development recently, then it benefits by new houses being built, because it then has to do the leak detection on it and the franchise. And so that's the reason why it was sold off.
Right.
You know, that will change. If we, because the interest rates hopefully are coming down, then that'll improve. And we'll see, you know, it should benefit also by the infrastructure side in the States, because obviously the Infrastructure Act. They came out with basically a bullish statement at the last trading update. And these are quite cautious guys. So, I mean, as I say, this won't, don't get me wrong, this will not shoot people's lights out. But if you get 10, 15% total return, including the dividend, over the long time, I'm as happy as Larry. I don't particularly, you know, I'd love to see it double like your HVivo, but frankly, I'm very happy with that type of return.
Yeah, nice steady growth.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, good. Right then, let's move to another one you've owned, which is Facilities of ADF, which does, I think, sort of like a trailer and trucks and stuff to help actors out in the field when they're sort of like film shooting. And it's a really unique business model, actually. But the shares have been hit because of the actors' strike and the director's strike last year, which put a sort of like a kibosh to a lot of new film development.
Yeah, I definitely missed time my entry into this one because that strike has obviously, you know, sent ripples through the entire film production industry.
Yeah. Zoo Digital's another one, isn't it?
Zoo Digital did get hit badly as well. What's their translation service?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. It does dubbing and stuff.
Yeah, I've seen this way down. I mean, its shares were hit quite hard. They have sort of recovered some of that ground. You know, since the resolution of the Hollywood writer strike, they did very well, you know, to keep things going in the way they did, you know, during that, because obviously they do a lot of work for some of the big streaming platforms, Netflix, you know, Amazon Prime, Disney, etc. But they were able to shift, you know, they were to keep the lights on, as it were, you know, by sort of jigging stuff around last year. We lost, you know, we saw a sort of top line fall, but actually we saw it, you know, it wasn't the absolute disaster that it could have been. As you say, it's a very, very unique business. There aren't many people doing this sort of thing in the UK. As you point out, you know, sort of artists' cabins, makeup trailers, honey wagons, which is what they call toilets in Hollywood.
Oh, is that okay?
Yeah, not Porterloos. They called honey wagons. It has a very large fleet of vehicles, strategically located, so it can get access to. Yeah. To kind of all the studios that it needs to get to. The backdrop of the streaming industry continues to invest heavily in content. Mm. We have a backlog, basically, of stuff that was planned that was put on hold. So there's a lot of pent-up demand. The sort of lingering after effects of the strike are still out there.
Yeah, I'd agree.
There's some logistical issues that continue, but it's in a very good place to pick up that business when it comes. The UK is a hotbed of film investment at the moment. There's already quite a few very large studios, and there are lots more being built all over the country. Big one up in Scotland, where I think ADF has got some presence. It's a great industry, and ADF is right in the heart of it.
Mm. I think you raise a brilliant point there, John, because you're right. We've had a temporary pause of films, but frankly, if you've got a blockbuster and you haven't been able to finish it off or get it started, it ain't going anywhere. You're still going to do it. And it just built up a huge backlog. If anything, this is going to have really high utilization rates, over the next sort of 18, 12 months, 18 months, 36 months, etc. And once that happens, you get those economies of scale, and you could really see effectively a huge surge in profitability over the next 3 to 4 years.
You would think so. I mean, it is a sort of a business that requires investment in the sort of physical fleet. It requires a bit of cash to do that. It's not like a software business. It's not a huge, gross margin type business, but they can command pretty decent prices for what they do. Mm. So it does make a nice chunk of change. What was EBITDA last year? 7.8 million EBITDA last year. By 2024, we should be up to 12 million EBITDA. But as I say, the DAR bit of that bothers me because, honey wagons depreciate.
Okay, definitely worth having a look at. It's only a 9x PE as well. I've got just one sort of final observation from George Annan again. He says he uses ChatGPT to help him read earnings reports and financial statements. Is that something you might consider? Because I know you do a lot of screening, don't you, already?
Yeah, so I mean, I would definitely, I do use ChatGPT for exactly that reason. You can pass stuff incredibly quickly. Mm. And so you can be much, much more efficient in your use of time to read financial statements. Screening, I've got lovely tools, use SharePad for that. And that's something I am going to be setting up come April as well, which is a sort of weekly screening video, looking at various approaches to stock screening. I am dubious about anything that can claim to see what happens in the future. Mm. Because, the stock market ultimately is a collection of the decisions of millions and millions and millions of individuals, human beings. And human beings are inherently both predictable but also unpredictable. Whilst you can sort of predict about the behavior of the masses for a while, there always comes a point where something strange happens, and the models can't predict that sort of thing.
Mm. It's strange, isn't it? Because obviously the Mag 7 has been a huge theme, just based because it's like a safety trade. It's the AI sort of craze mania, plus obviously the passives on board. And that seems to have gone further than most sensible investors would have expected. And that's because of not human beings make decisions. A lot of it's just by machines making
algos.
Decisions.
Yeah. But algos, I mean, they're not intelligent, are they? Really? They're formulas. Algos, it's also the speed at which you can transact, which often helps the algorithmic traders to kind of gain their little edge. But ultimately, as I say, AI is amazing. It's, what it can do is fantastic. It will change the way that many industries work. Mm. But I don't think it displaces, like human behavior. And I don't think, it's, as I say, claims that, that it can do things like predict the future. You're in crazy territory when you start thinking like that. It's fantastic stuff. And as I say, it's, the amazing tools out there, which people should definitely use. And I do. Why not? Why wouldn't you? It'd be mad not to.
Okay, right. We'll finish on one prediction, though, John. You're going to have to give me who's going to win the boat. Who's going to be in the boat race this weekend?
Oh God, is there a boat race this weekend?
Well, it must be because they're talking about the sewage levels in the Thames.
I'm glad to say Cambridge because they're nearest to me.
You've got a dark blue, aren't you? You got to be your Oxford.
No, it's Cambridge. It's up the road.
Okay. Well, anyway, thanks everyone for your questions. It's been great to answer them, and thanks again, John, for terrific insights. And really looking forward to getting that to land the first. Episode or the first edition of the new Growth Company Investor. So thanks again, and speak to you in a couple of months.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having us.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.